Hello and welcome to Live from America podcast, the Comedy Sellers podcast. This is Hatem, Norm Dorman's son, Manny. His birthday today, happy birthday. So he have a lot of kids in his house. So he's going to try to sneak and join us at some point. But if not, it's always better without him. Just kidding. Comedian Boris Aiken is here. Good to see
hello,
you.
Hello, hello. Likewise.
Long time. And our guest of honor, we've been trying to get him in the show for a while, finally happened. He's a doctor in New York and a frequent contributor at the New York Times opinion page and author of many books. One of my favorite, actually, author of Hard as a History. And his new book, it's a memoir, My Father's Brain. You can see the logo right behind me, Life in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. And I'll have the link to his book in the description. Dr. Sandeep Johar, hello, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Great book. It's kind of book that it's like, it's a novel, but a book of this, you know what I'm saying? Like there's a lot of emotions in it. I mean, let's start from the start. Like, what made you want to write this book? It's very, I highly recommend it. And I rarely read anything. So,
so to be serious, I know this is a comedy show, but you know, I wrote the book that I needed to have when I went through the journey, with my father. You know, he was a brilliant man, scientist, and, you know, he started to deteriorate in ways that I couldn't fathom. And I was kind of at a loss. And there really weren't any good books out there. I mean, there were some self-help books, but what I needed was sort of a personal chronicle of this journey. You know, as you said, you know, I wanted to write it almost like a novel, but then at the same time, I wanted to write a script for what to expect, you know, as you go down this journey, because I think when you have knowledge, it helps. It helps to be a better and more loving son, caregiver. And in many ways, I fell short, you know, when I was caring for my father, because I didn't really know what to expect. I'm sort of a hyper-rational person. And when he would act in ways that I just didn't understand, I became very frustrated. When he was basically like not my dad, I became very frustrated. And so I wrote the book that I needed. That's both a personal story, but also a book about the history and science of dementia and sort of bioethics and all the things that you need to help care for someone, you know, in this very difficult disease.
And that's one of the things I like about the book. I mean, my dad also had in his last day, he was going through, and there's no research. And I saw an interview of you before saying that even though you're a medical doctor, like you would know more than any of us, but you still felt like didn't have a lot of knowledge. So this is what I like about this book, is like you have knowledge and it's kind of like script, like I said, but you also tied it with real emotions, real stories, real fights, you know, all the stuff that actually happened. So, you know, it's a very interesting topic because, you know, like in one way, I want to, you know, talk about the book, but also about the whole disease itself. Like, what did you learn? Is it inevitable for anybody? Like now that the age, you know, the average age life expectancy is higher, is that like just going to happen to everybody?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and that's the question we all worry about, right? I mean, people worry about almost nothing more than cognitive decline, because cognitive decline is not like physical disease. Obviously, it's a physical disease, but it sort of like wipes out who you are, you know, yourself, your person. When you start to forget relationships, you forget your history, you lose autobiographical memory, all those things. It's very different. That's why people are more afraid of dementia than they are of cancer.
Yeah.
In fact, in polls, people are more afraid of dementia than they are of death. So, you know, it's not inevitable. There are things that we can do. And I write about that in the book. I mean, one of the things that's like really difficult with dementia is that we don't really know exactly what causes it. And when you don't have a causative sort of, factor, like we know what causes syphilis. We know what causes
Oh, Boris does know what syphilis. We didn't need a doctor for
not
this.
yet, I don't.
Sorry, I just opened you up for that. Sorry about that. I'll try to do more of that in during this
You
interview.
know what? Since I'm playing that role anyway, let me ask the dumb question. And that's that people have a myself at least have like a stereotypical understanding of what Alzheimer's is, cognitive decline as you describe. My understanding is it's also like one of the biggest killers in the country. How does that happen in terms of like how does that cognitive decline translate into relating to your mortality essentially?
Yeah, I mean that's a great question. I mean, these are all questions I grappled with, and I'm a doctor. I'm a heart doctor, but I went to medical school. I did residency. I did rotations on the neurology wards. Honestly, I didn't really know how does dementia cause death, right? But in the end, it's basically brain failure. So, Alzheimer's typically starts in the part of the brain that controls memory. So that's why people like forget what they had for lunch or what they did that day. Short-term memory. Long-term memory resides somewhere else in the brain that Alzheimer's doesn't get to until the last stages. So it starts in sort of short-term memory, and then it moves to a part of the brain that controls sort of is involved in processing of emotions. So people become emotionally volatile, and then it moves to areas where it affects judgment and whatever. Eventually, the brain becomes like degenerated, like brain cells die, and the disease sort of spreads outward from kind of here where the hippocampus is, where the memory centers are. That's typically where it starts, and it spreads outward. And eventually, it starts to affect parts of the brain that control like elemental functions like swallowing, and ability to walk, ability to move. Ability to translate thought into motor function. So it's essentially brain failure. But I would say that that brain failure translates into inability to move around. So you get pneumonia. That's a common way people die. Inability to properly urinate and empty your bowels and bladder. So you get urinary tract infections. And then eventually, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is that those basic like neural pathways get obliterated in a sequence that's almost opposite to where they came in when you're an infant. So like what's one of the first things infants do? They hold up their head. That's the last thing to go in dementia. What's one of the second things infants do? The social smile. That's like the second to last thing that goes in dementia.
Oh,
So it's like
wow.
almost like the most fundamental pathways that start when you're an infant, they get obliterated in the reverse order in dementia. But though when you lose those functions, then you sort of become open to pneumonia, infections. When you become bedbound, you can't move, you get bed sores. So all those things kind of is how people die.
It's a long process to care for someone who have Alzheimer's, like especially like from the beginning to like it lasts a long time. Insurance mostly doesn't cover stuff like that. Caregivers obviously also have their lives and their jobs and stuff like that. And there's a lot of emotions, and that's one of the things I also like about the book is they capture a lot of the emotions. So do you, and as I mentioned, my dad in his last days suffered from it as well. Do they know, like, when somebody have also, because that was my fear. I always think it's like, I hope he doesn't understand that this is happening to him. Like, do they understand that this is happening to them? Like, I know we feel, like you said in the book, like, I don't want, this is my dad. I don't want him to feel like that. I wouldn't do this. But do you think that he understand what's going on, or they understand what's going on in general, or it's different levels?
Early on, yes. So one of the things I wanted to provide in the book is sort of almost like a neurological script. Like, why do you lose this function at this time in stage one, and then this function in stage three? Obviously, it's mostly personal stories and scenes, and it's sort of like written like a novel, but I interject these like, you know, asides that kind of explain what is happening in the brain. So yeah, I mean, the part of the brain that controls self-awareness is in, I mean, not to get all like medical about it, but it's in the parietal and frontal lobes of the brain. And those parts of the brain are kind of far away from where the disease usually starts. So those are some of the last things, or let's say not the last things to go, but sort of that's in the mid range. So early on, my dad knew what was going on. I mean, he was, you know, he knew that something was wrong, but he kind of thought like, well, you can't remember everything. When you get older, you forget things. That's not a big deal. But I would try to like, and I was kind of in denial too. I was like, well, maybe this is just normal. But then, you know when it's not normal, like you just feel it, right?
Yeah.
You know that it's okay to forget where you parked your car, but it's not okay to forget that you have a car.
Yeah.
Right.
And I found it like it moves so quick. Like he was okay for a little bit and then have a little bit. And then all of a sudden it moves so quickly. It's like, boom.
Yeah. And a big thing, the reason why it accelerates so much is because my mom died. And we know that loneliness and sort of social isolation accelerates the cognitive demise from dementia. Because, you know, it's not just a medical disease. It's also like a psychosocial disease. So like the more kind of connections you have in your brain, the more you can withstand degeneration of brain cells, the more connections you have socially, the more you can withstand the disease process. So a big thing for him, I think it was slow moving until my mom died. And then all of a sudden it was just like, what happened? You know, what happened, you know, and some of that we thought was depression, but it was clear that the disease accelerated, you know, and yeah.
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, you mentioned kind of like sort of backwards from the skills that you gain from infancy, losing them. What about skills that are more abstract, like theory of mind? Would someone with dementia lose the idea that other people don't know the things that they know? And do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, I mean, that's a fairly higher order function of the brain, you know, to understand that you have a separate consciousness from other people. Yeah, that there was no indication that my dad had any sense of that. You know, the thing that was really bizarre with dementia that I found interesting and kind of almost philosophical is that, you know, in neurology, we have sort of meta functions like the brain, like, yeah, it helps you move, it helps you think, swallow, whatever. But there's also like higher order functions that where like, you know, you're thinking, right? You know that that like if consciousness is a movie, you're aware that you're in this movie. You know what I mean?
Okay.
That so there's a kind of a meta function that the brain provides. And when you lose that, and you lose self-awareness, then it's actually there's a term for it called anosognosia, which is an inability to recognize you have a disease because of the disease. And it's not just confined to dementia. People with schizophrenia very often are not aware that they're psychotic, that their reality doesn't correspond to the reality out there. People with OCD very often don't recognize that they have obsessional thinking. So the same thing goes with dementia. So I would say that early on, yes, you have awareness, but then when you start to lose that, and you lose that kind of ability to police your own thinking, that's when things go really awry.
I'm kind of worried because I think Norm forgot about the show. So let's let's hope that he didn't. So Boris, go. You had a second question, then I have a couple.
Oh man, I got a lot actually based on from what you're saying, but based on what you just said, that also, not to make light of it, but it sounds like the way people describe the phenomenon of being in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
How does that relate in terms of, you know, when you're in an activity, you might also lose self-awareness in a way when you're, you know, as people describe, like playing a perfect football game or like playing music that you're really into, which also, as I understand, people with dementia might, you know, might remember, like everyone's seen like viral videos of someone like playing the piano when they put it in front of them and stuff.
Yeah. And one of the things related to that, one of the things I write about in the book is the different sort of forms of memory. You know, we all know there's like episodic memory, semantic memory. Those are memories of facts or episodes in your life. That's what dementia and Alzheimer's obliterates. But there's also like muscle memory, ability, you know, remembering how to ride a bike. So you may be able to ride a bike, but not be able to describe how to ride a bike, you know? And so with dementia, like, yeah, you're right. I mean, procedural memory tends to remain fairly intact.
Okay. So, you know, we want to talk a little bit about the disease later and all that, but how can, you said that it could be preventable. Like, is, I know a lot of people like do like DNA test or see if it runs in a family or stuff like that, but is it avoidable? Is it like things that people can do? Like I hear a lot of people say like some mind exercise, and I don't know what's the scientific truth about that.
I mean, there's a lot of kind of pseudoscience out there about dementia and how to prevent it. So like doing puzzles isn't really going to prevent dementia. You know, like I said, we don't really know exactly what causes it. So, and I describe this in a lot of detail in the book. So if we could just like, just very briefly, just describe what we know. So for like, let's say the last 100 years, we thought that Alzheimer's was caused by plaques and tangles in the brain. Those are like misfolded proteins. So we had this idea that if we get rid of those proteins, we can either prevent or at least alleviate the decline from Alzheimer's. That didn't work for a very, very, very long time. Now, very recently, two drugs have come out that target those proteins and have been shown for the first time to slow cognitive decline. So I would say that, like, there's a, and I talk about this a lot in the book, but there's probably a major change today compared to even like 20 years ago. But while, you know, scientists were testing these anti-plaque drugs and they weren't working, they started to look at other causes. So one of the causes that they identified is, well, one of the things we know that dementia is associated with aging. What else is associated with aging? Well, plaques in the blood vessels, right? You get like coronary plaques, for example. You get a fatty buildup in the blood vessels in your body. So, and we know that happens in the brain too. So then there was this thought that vascular health could help prevent dementia, and there is data to support that. Eating a good diet, exercising. I mean, exercise is probably the single best thing you can do to attenuate cognitive decline, because
so is it a fact that Alzheimer's is only for older people?
No, it's not. So there is early onset Alzheimer's.
Like how late old? Onset Alzheimer's. How old is the youngest?
Like, you know, 45, 50. Okay. People can, but that's primarily a genetic disease, and that's related to these plaques and tangles I was talking about. Mm. But late onset, sometimes you see people with late onset dementia, and they don't have a lot of plaques and tangles when you image their brain, but they have a lot of like vascular disease. So to answer your question, we don't know exactly what causes it, but we do know certain factors that seem to help. One is exercise. One is having social connections and having a good sort of support group. One is diet. And probably the best data we have, and it's not great data, is for the Mediterranean diet and helping prevent. But that's probably through vascular issues, you know, because we know Mediterranean diet is good for the heart as well. And then probably high educational levels is protective, because, you know, I mean, I traveled the world, talking to experts and caregivers and sort of learned everything I could. And one of the neurologists I talked to is like, he's like, I think of dementia as just a math problem. You have these connections between brain cells, and as they die, the more connections you started with, the more likely you are to resist the cognitive decline. So educational levels are super important. So in his idea, dementia is just a math problem. You know, you start with more brain cells. Some people start with more brain cells. Some people start with less. Now that's an opening for you to say something to Boris.
I was about to, but you ruined it. Let's go with somebody who have less. So let's sign up for a couple of classes here. Yeah. So Boris, we can go one on one because I know you have a lot of questions and I have a lot of questions too.
Tons. Well, to go back to your personal experience, I think I personally have a 96-year-old grandmother right now who's like, I don't know that she has dementia. That might be what it is. I mean, essentially, like, her short-term memory is starting to fail.
Yeah.
And it's also the type of thing that she was like up until 91, 92, pretty sharp, and then had a fall. And that kind of precipitated a more sedentary recuperation period and everything like that. And just in general, it makes me think like I wasn't born here, and God bless this country, much prefer it than where I could be. However, there's an institutionalized setting in which kind of most elderly people end up. And it's very, on the one hand, it's because we have the capacity to do it. On the other hand, you know, if we were back in Ukraine, my grandmother would be where my great grandmother was, which is living with three other generations, and at nearly 90, still helping to take care of me on her own when people were out and things like that. And so, you know, you mentioned social connection, and there's got to be some sort of, I guess, tension between all the benefits of the system we have that can provide for somebody a bed with hundreds of thousand dollars worth of medical equipment, theoretically, and a medical system where I was, you couldn't trust that somebody was even being given the drug that they're supposed to be given rather than being sold on the black market somewhere. But on the flip side, you know, obviously we all love her, but my grandmother lives on her own. She has caretakers that come and help out. My mom is there like almost every day, but it's not quite the same as, you know, literally living with three different generations.
Add to that question to let, because that was also almost was going to be my question, is like to ask you, because I've went through the same thing. I'm sure you went through things. Do you put them in a hospital, nursing home setting where you think they will have a great, or you take care of them personally? Which one is better?
Yeah, well, I mean, so there's so much to discuss here, but I mean, I never wanted my dad to go to an institution. I don't like the way this country treats people with dementia. I traveled, you know, really the world to sort of investigate other ways of being, other ways of caring for people with dementia.
This is also as his will, correct? Like, he told you not that he doesn't want to go.
I mean, I don't think anyone ever wants to end up in a nursing home, especially the kind in the U.S. I mean, I agree with you, Boris. I mean, it's like the way that we treat the elderly in this country is pretty dehumanizing. We didn't always do that, by the way. Like, you talk about multi-generational families. We used to have that in this country, in the United States. About 100 years ago, multi-generational families were almost the norm. People used to live, on farms, and there were several generations inside the home. And when someone started to decline, there was always someone around to help them. But things have changed. And I would say for the good in a lot of ways, right? I grew up, I moved out of my house. My parents didn't sort of expect me to stick around and, I don't know, carry on the family business and kind of like thwart my ambitions. So, you know, women work outside the home now, right? I mean, everyone would say that's a good thing. But the problem is that when people start to decline, there isn't a social safety net in this country. Government, like you said, just doesn't provide any help. And the way that we in this country kind of think about elder care is let's prioritize safety over autonomy, right? You don't want your grandmother to wander, fall, and break her hip. No one does. But what price are you going to pay to prevent her from doing that? So, like, one of the things I did is I went to the Netherlands and I went to a dementia village where they let people wander. They don't confine them to locked memory units. People can walk around, you know, visit the fountain, feed the pigeons. You know, there's a fountain there. And my guide was like, yeah, people were like, oh, you can't have a fountain. Actually, there's a lake. There's a little pond there. He's like, you can't have a pond. Because what if people like jump in? And he's like, what the fuck? You know, like people with dementia aren't stupid. They're not going to like climb over a fence and jump into a pond, you know. But in America, we think, oh, well, no, I mean, you got to like prevent, you know,
insurance. It's a liability.
It's a liability. There's a lot of medical legal stuff involved. So I would say that this country is fantastic for a lot of things, helping you achieve your potential, letting children go out and blaze their own paths. It's great for economic productivity. But when you start to decline from dementia, there are many other countries out there that treat their elderly with a lot more respect and a lot more caring. And there's a lot more sort of government help. I mean, you know, in India, there's no government help. But there's a social safety net, which is like having sons.
Yeah.
And actually having married sons. Right, because it's the daughters-in-law who are the ones who are gonna, you know, who do the caring.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty, you know, reasonable safety net in Europe, Western Europe. There are a lot of government help. In the United States, we don't have the family safety net because we don't have multi-generational families, and at the same time, we don't have government help. Like dementia costs $200 billion a year. The government covers $11 billion. Out of that $200 billion, the rest of his family's having to pay out of pocket. So there's just really no social safety net. So I would say that this country is fantastic for, you know, if you have, I don't know, some rare cancer or something, and you need like a, you know, PET scan, and you need some sort of like incredible, you know, monoclonal antibody or whatever, nothing can beat this country. But when it comes to like run-of-the-mill care, and especially when you get older, like elder care is just not even in people's minds in this country.
I think there's a lot of some cultures, and then a lot of you Boris ask as well. It's against the culture to let the elderly go to like a nursing home or something like that.
Yeah.
But still, my question is, because I personally was, you know, dealing was like, which one do you do? Like kind of like Boris touched on it a little bit. Do you want the person that you love to be taken care of 24 hours, if you can afford it, obviously, and put them in a place where you know they're going to have doctors and medication and stuff like that? Or is it more important for the person in that situation, I'm talking scientifically,
yeah,
to be surrounded by the people that they love and know in a living situation?
Yeah, most elder care experts, most geriatricians say that aging in place in your home is much better than going into an institution. Because in the institution, yes, you have doctors and nurses, but I mean, you've been in nursing homes, right? I mean, it's like the ideal of it pales before the reality, which is like people go untended. They very often are prevented from doing just even the basic things that they want to do. They have to eat when they're told. I mean, I don't want to say it's a prison, but it's dehumanizing. And most people want to live more autonomous lives. And you do that better when you're at home. Now, the problem is that it's expensive, right? I mean, I'm a doctor, my brother's a doctor. We had resources in my family. I can't, even with all the help that we were able to buy, it was still like an incredibly arduous process. I can't imagine for people who don't have the resources, like what they go through, but they do every single day. There are millions of untrained family caregivers in this country. And, you know, we can do better. Like we have to do better.
Yeah.
So is it an issue? Because like you mentioned two examples, you said a Scandinavian, right? The dementia village. And so that sounds like
the
something
Netherlands,
Netherlands. So, and that sounds like something where you need the financial support of your government institutions, I guess. And then on the flip side, you mentioned India as an example where that's more about not so much the institutions, but the values and the culture of the people.
Yeah.
And so in America, it almost seems like we both don't have the cultural value where it's customary to take in, you know, an aging relative, but we also don't have the institutional value to devote resources to that. And is that just a result? Like, you know, it's quick for a lot of people to be like, oh, the, you know, it's insurance companies and it's the system that doesn't support this. But if we don't support it ourselves as a people in terms of our behavior and value, aren't those institutions just kind of reflecting the values of the people in the same way that, I mean, you mentioned how much more difficult it must be for somebody without the financial resources to deal with somebody with dementia. But at the same time, people say that with kids all the time. And yet poor people end up having more kids than wealthier people a lot of times because people just grin and bear it. And they might, you know, you might have the same thing where poor people are taking better care of someone that's elderly in their family. And they do have a multi-generational situation or whatever because of financial, you know, restrictions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it money? Is it a culture of value? Is it both? Is this just the way people seem to want it in America?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's like the reason why we don't prioritize elder care is because we don't value older people. I mean, we really don't. I mean, I think it's a cultural thing, but the cultural thing then gets expressed into our institutions. Like, what do we value in America? Like, Americans don't have the least amount of vacations that compared to their Western European counterparts. We value economic productivity. We value the ability to process information, right? I mean, so much of our economy is information-based now. And forget about the economy. Just what do we do every day? We're on our smartphones. We're constantly getting inundated with information. And if you can't process that information, if you can't add to the conversation, you become marginalized. Your people don't care about you. And that is true in many different cultures, I would say. I mean, I don't want to idealize Eastern cultures and say, oh, India's great. I mean, they're starting to put elderly people in nursing homes too. I mean, I was just talking to someone from India who's like, yeah, the nursing homes are sprouting up in big cities also. So it's not like, you know, in China, they call dementia, the literal translation is something like elderly retardation. You know, so it's not like Eastern cultures are perfect, but in America, I would say that there's just this tremendous focus on productivity, on the ability to think. And when you can't think, you know, I in the book I call it our hypercognitive culture. And when you are not part of that culture, then you become marginalized, not just by the world, but even within your own family. I mean, one of the things that was really painful to explore in the book is how I fell short as a son, as a caregiver, because that part of, you know, the prioritization of the virtues of productivity and thinking and hypercognitivism, that's all in me too. And when my father started to fall short of that, I couldn't help but treat him differently, even though he was still my dad.
So if we take it to like a political side a little bit, we see a lot of all the presidential races, Biden, Trump, and stuff like that. And they talk a lot about, being older and president. And do you see any sign? Do you ever see signs like this in a president? Like, oh, this is something that we should be worried about since the election season is coming up soon.
Do you ever diagnose someone through your television?
Yeah, you'll be like, you see Biden, or you see, I mean, Trump didn't do it a lot, but sometimes, but
yeah,
Biden more. Do you see, but is that in general something that we should be worried about in a president? Like, could that hit? Like, can you see signs and be like, oh my God, this could be much, much worse? Or they can last 4 years and
yeah.
without covering it?
Yeah. I mean, now you're going to get me into trouble. but hell yeah, right?
No.
I mean, hell yes. If 1 out of 10 Americans over the age of 65 have dementia, then, and that number increases as you get older, there's no reason to think that our politicians, our lawyers, our doctors, our accountants, our pilots, well, pilots are different, right? Pilots, we say, is a hard stop, right? You can't fly over a certain age.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. There's a mandatory mandatory retirement age. I think it's 65 for commercial pilots. No matter how sharp you are, no matter what you're, I think
not
that's
if you're flying the country.
Right. I mean, but if you're private, I think is different. But even private, I think there are some regulations. But we don't have those regulations for people like doctors, right? I mean,
it's actually 60. I just Google it.
Yeah, 60. Right. So nowadays, doctors are getting older. They're part of the baby boomer generation. And I wrote an article in the New York Times about a 100-year-old doctor, like, he seemed perfectly fine, by the way. I mean, he seemed like an incredible guy. He's a neurologist. He loves his job. But the fact is that as you get older, you start to have decline. I mean, I think with Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, I'm sorry, not Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, we're seeing some...
It's an honest mistake.
Seeing some aspects that are really worrisome, right? She had herpes encephalitis, she seems to have some decline. I mean, I'm not diagnosing her from afar, but I mean, the fact is that, that even her own staff is saying that she's having a hard time processing, information. So yeah, I mean, I would say that we definitely need to be worried. Now, I'm going to leave Joe Biden out of it. But it stands to reason.
But I mean, Joe Biden is the one that's showing most of signs that, for me, like,
it's a stutter. He's been stuttering his whole life, Adam.
Yeah. I mean, some
no,
of
no,
it
but
is
I know that. But I'm saying, like, there's other stuff that you can
I'm
see.
Teasing.
I'm not saying the guy is bad. There's not. It's a if it's a disease, it's a disease. I'm saying, like,
how
it's
do you,
one of the things that you want to worry about the candidate that you want to support.
Yeah. I mean, even Democrats are saying, is he too old?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I'm not saying Joe Biden has dementia, but I mean, I think a demented Joe Biden is probably better than the alternative that we're going to be faced with. But anyway, this is not, I don't want to get into the politics of it, but yeah,
well,
I would
just
say,
ask,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want to ask, how do you walk that line between having these rules in society that limit the risks of, potentially people with dementia being in positions where a plane could go down or the country could go down, and approaching the disease itself with dignity in a way where you're not creating rules in society that say, hey, sorry, you're at risk for this now, you're out. You're now in a different position as a human being in terms of your potential contributions to society.
Yeah. So I would say, and I wrote an op-ed about this in the New York Times a few months ago. I would say that there's a middle ground. So there's, you know, there's the mandatory retirement, which no one really thinks of as very fair, right? Because people age differently. There are 65-year-old doctors who are clearly declining. There are 75, 80-year-old doctors who, you know, I would trust with a family member. So I don't think it's fair to say, well, this is a hard cutoff like we do for pilots. On the other hand, it's like hands off doesn't seem like a great strategy either. Like let people decide on their own when to retire, because as we pointed out earlier, you lose self-awareness as you become, you know, impaired, cognitively impaired. So I would say that competency testing is the way to go, where you don't mandate retirement, but you do mandate over a certain age, 70, 72, 7, you know, 68, whatever. I mean, we can decide that people should be administered basic competency testing. And it has to be tailored, right? So a surgeon has to have a vision exam. A psychotherapist may not necessarily need the vision exam, but needs to be able to like have a good hearing. You know, the basic competency testing, I think that we need to do. I advocate for that for doctors, but the fact is we should be doing that for other professions that have our lives in our hands, like someone who has their finger on the nuclear button. We need to make sure that they can process information properly. So I think that's the next sort of frontier, because Americans, you know, the you know, elder Americans are sort of monopolizing positions of power. I mean, you look at politicians; so many of them are fairly old. We need to make room for younger people.
Yeah. I agree with you. Sometimes you will see that, you know, some jobs require experience, and it comes from, and also requires relationships.
Yeah.
So I understand that. And by the time you add to your lobby, you're going to get, but, you know, I think it's fair. I think if somebody, like, there should be a test and everything, and if they pass it for all the jobs, you know, that require certain things, they should go through it, you know? And if they pass, they pass. But, you know, just the fact that we, you know, part of treating them with dignity, and we're all going to be through this, and, you know, humanity, is not to have an expiration date in a sense, you know, tell people like, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that. But at the same time, there's certain jobs that you're going to be like, okay, you know, I'm worried about your actions, you know. But, you know, my question about Joe Biden was more is like, is these actions just like, could not be, like, maybe it's not Alzheimer's, maybe it's just somebody forgetting something actually, or is that like solid, you know, a diagnose if you look at it?
You can't diagnose without neuropsychiatric testing.
Okay.
You know, the fact is that older people very often will have sort of, let's say, senile moments. They'll forget the name of someone. And yeah. I can imagine he's got a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure and is being inundated with a lot of information. And I could imagine him forgetting names or whatever. So it's really hard to say based on what you see at like press conferences, or really a lack of press conferences in his case. It's hard to make that diagnosis, but, you know, until like it becomes obvious, like that's the thing with my dad, you know, it's like, you know, he would be like, hey, look at this picture. Do you know who this is? I'd be like, yeah, that's my son when he was like 4 years old. He's like, yeah. And it was pretty clear that he was just, wasn't testing me. He was trying to get me to tell him.
Yeah.
You know, and that became, at first it was like, oh yeah, it's like, you know, that's just like my dad testing me, like he used to test me in geometry, whatever. But it became pretty clear that this was like, you know, he was really declining. And so obviously with politicians, we don't want to wait till it becomes really clear and something really bad happens. So, you know, it's something that we're going to have to address as a country that we haven't addressed. But the fact is that we are growing older as a society, and there's more dementia, and there will be more dementia. I mean, in fact, you know, I think I said it right in the book that the number of people with dementia will double by 2050.
Why is that?
Because people are getting older.
Okay.
And there's also, you know, a greater recognition of the problem. So that, I mean, it's a mixed bag, but I think with aging and, you know, as the baby boomers age, you're going to see a tremendous amount of dementia. And we see,
I like
that
the name baby boomers, but aging, baby boomers aging.
Yeah.
Baby and aging is just like weird.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, for you know, for sure. I think, do you think that, why is the lack of you know, the help from the government and all that? Why are we not taking care of? Is it under research? Is it there's just no funding for it? Like, what's the reason that we're not, you know, doing a good job with providing options for older people?
I mean, I think it's that we don't really care.
Mm.
I mean, there are other ways to spend our money. You know, there are societies that really value the elderly. You know, when my dad first moved to New York, he was living in the Midwest, and he was a, you know, very, actually pretty eminent scientist, and published in all the best journals. And when we brought him out, I called a hotline to see what kind of help I could get for him and my mother. My mother actually had Parkinson's. I could, you know, cursed family. But my mother had Parkinson's, my dad had Alzheimer's. But, you know, I would call, and it was pretty clear that there was nothing unless you could pay. Like, there were organizations that were like, we'll do this, we'll do this. But it was very clear that it was all for payment. No one was going to do anything for free. And the Medicare doesn't provides very little help, except if you're like at the end stage, like through hospice care, or if you've been hospitalized, and then only for like a limited period, for like a couple of weeks, physical therapy or whatever. So everything else was like coming out of, you know, your own pocket. And if you don't have any money to spend, then you've got to take the burden on yourself.
Mm.
And I think that's why caregivers get burnt out, because it's just an overwhelming amount of work. I mean, taking care of a baby is pretty overwhelming, but caring
that's what
for
Boris is going through right now.
Yeah, really? Right. Oh, congrats.
Got a 1 year old, thanks.
Yeah, but caring for an older person?
Yeah, it's very hard, yeah.
Would you say it's an industrialization thing? Like, you described, like, especially in the city, you know, our demographics in America and a lot of other industrialized countries, you know, people have less kids because they're not farmhands. They're, you know, expensive roommates, basically. And so, especially in cities, people do that. Is that does that sound like it's the same phenomenon, essentially, that, you know, unless you're a working hand, you're sort of a cost in the world where, you know, real estate is at a premium and your productivity is sort of like reduced to not quite farmhands, but like, you know, sitting in a cubicle?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think one of the transitions, the reason why we transition to nuclear families from multi-generational families, is because we moved out of the farming culture into more of a, you know, industrial and then post-industrial culture, where, you know, there was a great premium on space, right? I mean, you know, older people don't pay for themselves.
Right.
You know,
unless they earned enough to, you know.
I'm surprised, though, because there's a lot of, like, usually, especially in voting, a lot of like solid voters are older. You know, I'm surprised that they're not using that weapon.
Well, I mean, yeah.
The ones that have dementia are not using it, and the ones that don't have dementia might be prioritizing themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it has to do, it's not just aging, but it's like, It's like how you're aging.
Yeah.
You're aging out of an ability to be productive. Then I think you end up getting marginalized.
You lose political power.
So your advice right now for any listener who listen to this and be like, okay, I don't want to do this. I don't want this to happen to me. So what should they do? Like you mentioned, exercise.
Tough shit.
Yeah. Exercise. You know what's funny? I was calling Tony Darrow the other day. I was like, my friend, comedian Tony Darrow. And I was like, dude, I called you. You never called me back. He's older than me. And he's like, oh, he did? I forgot that you called me. I was like, you're crazy. He was like, what did you want? I was like, fuck, I forgot what I want too. It's like,
that happens to me all the time.
Yeah. So I always think, especially with my, like, well, I cannot have you here in the podcast and not talk about the heart, you know. Now, what I want to tell you, you belong to Northwell, right? My yeah. favorite hospital. 2018, you know, I found myself in a coma, and then I wake up, and then they told me your heart stopped and you need an LVAD. Then I have an LVAD for 2 years, and then I had a heart transplant in 2020 in Northwell. I know.
Are you
I know.
Kidding me?
Just like
so you're just bringing this on me like
just now. I mean,
live on the podcast.
Yes, right, live at the end. You know,
that's incredible. I had no idea.
But to your point at some point, you know, between the LVAD and before the LVAD, when I was on and off coma, it's like the brain when you can remember anything or what happened. Like I think I went through a period, and it's funny because when I woke up, they asked my brother to write me a sign in every language that I ever spoke and have it there, because they're not sure which one I'm going to remember when I wake up. And there's a lot of, but I tell you, like the most painful pain for through all this was the brain, was when you're in coma, you hear like tit, 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 like this nonstop. This is your brain working. But
Wait. Yeah. So you were in an induced coma, but you were still awake?
No, but I was feeling like I was hearing that beeps the whole time, 24 hours, you know, 7 days. Wow. It was so painful. You know that joke when somebody's like, I just wake up from coma, and he's like, can I get 2 more hours? I just need to sleep for 2 more hours. You know, it's so true because he's so tired.
Wow.
But
no, that's incredible. I had no idea. I mean, I would say that neurology is at a very different stage than the heart. You know, you probably know I wrote a book about the heart.
Yeah, so, one of my favorite. Yeah.
Heart
and your TED Talk is amazing. It's, you know, it's really, that's why maybe we spend the last few minutes and then we'll go back to the book to finish it. But, you know, his TED Talk is a lot of like, does the emotion really come from the heart? And you want to touch on that a little bit, because, you know, we have all that, I love you or I hate you, yeah, or whatever. Right. And that sensation, is that actually scientifically coming from the heart?
Well, no. I mean, emotions are really a brain phenomena. But the thing is that what's interesting about the heart and emotions that I talk about in the TED Talk is that, you know, for the longest time, the heart was associated with the emotions. It was associated with courage, you know, like
got heart.
Take heart.
Yeah.
You know, or it was associated with sympathy, you know, have a heart.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. And this is something that's cross-cultural. And this is something that goes back to Greek times.
Yeah.
If not before, this conception that the heart is associated with emotions. So, but then at some point in our intellectual history, we started to think of the heart as just a pump. But what's interesting is that in modern times, we've seen how emotions affect the heart. You know, pretty much everyone now knows about the broken heart syndrome, where your heart acutely weakens and actually changes shape in response to tremendous grief, like the loss of a loved one, or like the breakup of a romantic relationship. Your heart physically changes shape and it weakens. And I've seen
it becomes a finger.
right.
Broke up with me.
Yeah, right, right, exactly.
Yeah, no, that's why this TED Talk was incredible. So the shape actually changes?
Yeah, the shape changes into, a sort of balloons out. The apex, the sort of the end portion of the heart balloons out, and it's actually shaped like an octopus trapping pot called a Takotsubo. So that a lot of people, they don't call it broken heart syndrome or stress cardiomyopathy. They call it Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, and this has been seen.
Is the opposite true?
So if you're really happy, So what's interesting is that if you're like super happy or like super surprised by like a surprise birthday party, something like that, your heart can also change shape, but it doesn't change shape in such a bad way. So, so the point is that there's a lot of mystery associated with this. Why would different emotional responses like grief versus like happiness result in different changes in the shape of the heart? We don't really know at this point, but the fact is that the heart and the emotion, the heart is not just a pump. It's not just this bland pump that's just, it responds to emotions. We know that people who undergo chronic stress have more heart disease. People who are depressed have worse outcomes after heart attacks or more predisposed to heart attacks. So we know that both chronic and acute stress has tremendous effects on the heart. So one of the things that I write about in Heart of History is how the metaphorical heart, the heart that we think of as like the reservoir of emotion, and the biological heart that we have conceived of in the modern era as like this pump that has like pipes and wires and all this other incredible stuff associated with it, that the metaphorical heart and the biological heart intersect. And that's one of the key themes in that book.
Oh, it's just amazing. You know, something interesting is like, I never used to love, like, I never drink coffee. I hate coffee, and after the surgery, I drink coffee all the time.
It's good for the heart.
Yeah. And, but that's the thing is like a lot of people that have a transplant, they say like, there is habits that wasn't there then, they picked it up. I don't know if that's, I don't know if there's a change in the DNA or not, but. Yeah. The one thing changed that I never liked Boris before or after the heart.
I talked to someone, I talked to a surgeon who said that he operated on someone who loved salad or maybe hated salad before the surgery. And after the surgery, he couldn't get enough of salads.
That's exactly what happened with coffee.
It was just like this totally different.
Yeah.
Thing it completely changed.
I could not stand the smell of coffee. Now I cannot stop. I have to drink coffee all the time. It's crazy, but it's
And you like Jews now?
Yeah, I do. Right, and this is another thing that I got. How long I waited for the heart? I can't remember. Like I had the LVAD for like a year and a half, and then maybe 9 months after this, 2 years almost. If I was in Russia, I could have got it right away. Just a couple of bucks here or there.
Or China, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know Dr. Brian Lima?
Of course.
Dr. Lima, yeah, he's the one that's the operating surgery. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point.
He moved to Texas.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
That is an interesting point, right? They say that, like, America's, like you said, the best system if you have like a lot of money and you need like some really specific thing. Is there an argument that maybe if you have a lot of money, it is better to be in Russia or China because you can buy a heart on the black
it's
market
true.
From someone? You don't have to wait on a list.
But then you have to have the best doctors to operate and the staff.
And those aren't over there.
Yeah. So you can, I guess you can, you can see it, but with it's funny when you said that the heart was more than a pump. When I had the LVAD, the LVAD, for those who don't listen, is kind of like it's an artificial part of the heart that pumps. So it's more. So that was the function that's going, but other things else is going. It's it's great. What's your thoughts on the guy that had the pig heart for a little bit?
It's incredible. If pig hearts would work. I mean, they don't work perfectly, obviously. There's still a lot of rejection, and there's we worry about like certain viruses in pigs that, you know, get move into humans and can cause horrible things. There are ways of sort of mitigating that. But yeah, I mean, if it works, then it sort of puts LVADs out of business.
Yeah.
And it puts even like human transplants, like right now, like the only way we help someone with a transplant is someone has to die.
Yeah.
And these days, a lot of people are overdosing. They have been from not so much like I'd say now, but like 2 years ago, 3 years ago with the opioid crisis, a lot of people were overdosing and there were a lot of hearts available.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's sad that, you know, that for something to be life-giving like that, someone has to die. There has to be a tragedy. So yeah, I mean, if pig hearts worked, it would just be completely.
This is one of the things that you really struggle with when you're waiting for a heart is knowing that someone else is, you know, is gonna die for you to get. It's hard, but
that'd be a dilemma.
But you know what's interesting is like if we say talk about this, like you said, the drugs. You know, when there was, I remember those days when there was a pandemic, but of the drugs and so many hearts were available at that time. But also, you know, what's interesting is that my doctor, and you know that obviously, is they would tell me like, be ready for the phone call. It's St. Patrick's Day. It's New Year's Eve. It's, you know, so whenever there's a major heart, please don't drink and drive. Wow. You know, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I didn't figure out why I hated holiday recently. Like I used to like party all the like holiday. I love it. And it's like, why am I so depressed? And I remember because every time they tell me like have to be close to the hospital, it's 4th of July.
Yeah.
Someone is gonna, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, happen. Don't drink and drive, to do drugs. Buy the book. What else in my list?
Pig hearts would be quite a dilemma for a lot of old Jews, right? There's no way it's kosher to take a pig heart.
Actually, it's one of the things that all the
what about pig valves? The people are putting in a lot of pig valves.
Yeah, right. I wonder if you observe.
I've had Jewish patients who've been like, yeah, I'm not sure, you know, I want that.
Right.
But then they also do cow valves, bovine.
Oh, okay.
Valves as well.
Yeah,
but so, not I a mean, cow heart, I doubt.
But I think, you know, well, thank you so much. We're going to get you again for the heart next time. I just wanted to throw that bomb on you, but I wanted to focus on the book today because it's amazing book. And I have it right here. I'm reading it right now. I can see it from the camera, but you know, can you see? Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And it's just like, it's emotions and facts. And for someone that me personally went through this is, and just like you said, you're a doctor and you didn't even know a lot about it. So to be able to put this in writing and tie it with real life situation, family situation, emotions, I think it's amazing. And I think don't wait for you. Don't forget to buy the book. If you forget, then you definitely need to buy the book. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But boys, final thoughts?
No, this was really fascinating. I enjoyed talking to you. It's a shame Noam's not here. I feel like he would have loved talking to you as well.
Yeah,
I have one final question, and that's that I found myself interchangeably using Alzheimer's and dementia. And am I understanding correctly that Alzheimer's is a disease and dementia is a potential effect that could have other causes?
I would say that dementia is a syndrome that results from brain cell death. And Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. So Alzheimer's also results in neurons dying. And I'd say 70% of dementia is Alzheimer's, but 30% isn't. Maybe 15 to 20% is strokes and sort of vascular damage. And then there's other things like Bruce Willis has frontotemporal dementia.
Yeah.
Some people have Lewy body dementia, which is associated with Parkinson's disease. So they're sort of different kinds, but Alzheimer's is like the emperor of all dementias.
Yeah. Yeah. The I was going to talk about Bruce Willis a little bit. So I hope that, you know, I thank you so much for being here. And I hope like, you know, people had to learn. I know I learned a lot. And I think the lesson beside buying the book and understanding, you know, and being prepared is like, enjoy life. You know, enjoy it right now. Enjoy, like, I'm not saying anything bad is going to happen, but be prepared, but enjoy every moment. Like, since the surgery, I know that, you know, nothing is for granted. So take, enjoy every simple thing in life, you know. And yeah, that will be it. But thank you so much. I'll have the link to your book. If anybody want to get it in the description, do you, you guys want to share where people can follow you if you have anything coming up? Boris, you want to go first?
Sure. At the Boris K, follow Airbnb Drama Podcast. I'll be at the Dojo of Comedy June 16th, and I will be at the Williams Center.
I was testing 17th. You. Show that I'm producing.
That's right.
There you go. Oh, if you enjoy, you live in Jersey? Dr. Sid, live in Jersey?
No, I live in Long Island.
Oh, okay.
Well, I had to think for a second. Oh, wait, where do I live? No.
Oh. we have this comedy festival coming up soon, so I'll send you an invite anyway.
I would love to go. So I'm not like Boris. I don't have like this, you know, these like things. I mean, my book tour is done, so I'm probably going to be at Boris's thing in wherever you said it was.
Good, I'll see you there. Like, I'll buy the
you'll
book.
You'll probably find me there. But yeah, no. My website is just my name, sandeepjahar.com. You can go there and sort of see, you know, read up on my other books or read articles I've written or whatever. And I hope to come to one of Boris's shows and. Thank you so much for inviting me. This was really fantastic.
Thank you very much. And next time I will be in person Live from America podcast. And you can email us at lifeamerica@comedyseller.com. Come watch the shows at the Comedy Cellar. I'll check and know him, see why he forgot to come in, and maybe we diagnose him. Thank you guys very much. Always great.